Welcome to the International Connection. Today we continue our conversation with Lyndon LaRouche from his jail cell in Alexandria, Virginia.
Mr. LaRouche, I'd like to go into some miscellaneous topics. Could you explain to our audience the significance of the person Fritz Kramer over the last 40 years?
Well, Fritz came to the United States from Germany in 1938 approximately. Came under various kinds of suspicion at various points, but did emerge during the course of the war and after it as a significant intelligence specialist. At one point, according to Fritz's own account, that Henry Kissinger was picked out of the mud of a replacement depot in Louisiana.
Yes.
Selected to become Fritz's translator jeep driver for the Oberammergau U.S. intelligence unit in the occupation period. Kramer then went on to the Defense Department, where he sat for years as a high-level permanent official, sorting out the mail, more or less, in an accomplishment job, reading the mail, so to speak, and piecing together what was going on in the world, and playing a significant hand in the shaping of some careers of some people, including Henry's at one point, Alexander Higgs, and others. So he's retired a few years back, has a Swiss chalet that he repairs to, comes back to the United States, and is still a man of some influence or diminishing influence today.
Wasn't he personally connected to some oligarchic families himself?
Yes, he pretends to be connected to Prussian and other families in Europe, but with fellows like that, I wouldn't take that testimony at face value. He's a bit of a braggart.
Yeah.
And he's an unquestionably an influential fellow and important in that sense. But I think he exaggerates his own importance considerably.
But he was important in determining policy.
In influencing policy, yes. Very important. It was sort of a little spider sitting in his nest, spinning webs. And the cumulative effect of his spinning these webs and the sponsorship he had in spinning webs over the years added up aggregately to a significant influence. Kissinger, I think, at one point, owes a great deal to him.
Yes.
So I think Fritz will tend to exaggerate how much Kissinger owes to him. Haig undoubtedly owes a great deal to Kramer, and probably might be inclined to more. In that case, Fritz wouldn't exaggerate so much. But there's no question he's influential, extremely so.
Well, did he have a conscious plan in his policies to help the Anglo-Soviet trust and things like that?
I would say that Fritz is essentially an Anglophile, a very special type. I don't think most people in the United States or Canada would really understand this phenomenon, because you have to know a good deal of German history in Fritz's case to understand this kind of Anglophile, how it breaks down. Because there are various degrees of Anglophilia in German history. For example, the Kaiser Wilhelm of World War I was a very pronounced Anglophile.
Yeah.
So he hated some of the he hated the Edward, for example. I think he liked King George V. But so one would have to know that this is tied to a very specific interest in Britain, and he was promoted that, he decided to commit himself to making himself useful to that particular Anglo-American current.
Yeah, this is Kramer.
Yes, right.
All right, now, did you know that Peter Drucker was one of the people who sponsored him in the 30s?
I think I knew of something I could actually. I don't know the Drucker thing in detail. I couldn't testify to myself.
Yeah, he, if you want to check it out, he wrote a book called Adventures of a Bystander in 1979, where he talked about his helping Kramer, they were old college buddies in Frankfurt, bringing Kramer over in the 30s. He did.
I knew something about Drucker. I knew Drucker from another standpoint, from the management philosophy standpoint, as opposed to this one.
But yeah,
I didn't know he had some connection.
You didn't know that. But Drucker is an example of, you would consider him an opponent, his worldview.
Drucker was a very intelligent fellow. He is a Frankfurt influence, particularly ISR type of influence.
Who?
The Institute for Social Research, which is called the Frankfurt School, was very influential. And Drucker was a very intelligent fellow. He wasn't stupid, and unfortunately, many people in the management consulting profession are just plain stupid. But he would be an adversary in one sense, but after coming out of a day's work or a month's work with some very stupid, ordinary thoughts of management consultants, Drucker would be refreshing.
He'd yes.
employ an adversary because he wasn't stupid.
Yeah. All right. I'd like to... are you familiar with the William Torbit document?
I know. Yes, I am. But not. But I wouldn't say...
you haven't read it.
I've read it, but I'm not... that's a very complex document.
Yes.
To say one understands it, to say one has read it is simple. To say one has understood it is something else again.
Right. Well, you have a very interesting statement in the second issue of Dope Incorporated. The one came out in 85, 80.
Oh, I didn't write that, but I know who did, and I know the work, yes.
Yeah, and I'm talking about the Kennedy assassination. You have here, the EIR people have this, by no later than 1943, as a part of the Yalta process accepted by FDR, both the Soviet and Anglo-American intelligence services had begun recruiting from the ranks of the most rabid Nazis for post-war intelligence work. Anglo-Soviet cooperation in such projects actually reflected a long-standing deal struck between Churchill and members of the Soviet Cheka of Felix Dzerzhinsky during Lenin's lifetime. Among those recruited were the East European Solidaris, who became an all-purpose asset of combined British and Soviet networks in the post-war period. Among the services rendered by these Eastern Nazis was the penetration of right-wing circles in the West. Now, it goes on to say that this Solidaris gang, which is named in the Torbit document, was one of the factors, probably around George de Moorenschild, in the Kennedy assassination.
Right. That's all substantiated.
Yeah, you would agree with that part of the Torbit document.
Oh, yes, that's the point. Where I have a problem with this thing is the motivation.
With what thing?
For the Kennedy assassination and the Torbit books.
Oh, the problem with the Torbit document.
You're right. What I have a problem with this is not with the facts, because I've gone over very closely the work of Judge Garrison and many others.
Yes.
And we've done some independent work and have obtained some primary evidence on the matter so that we know something about it.
Has it been published?
It's been reflected in the editions of Dope Inc.
All right.
Including that one. That we have some holographic material from some of these people which helped us to track the network to show that it actually did exist.
What's holographic material?
In the handwriting of some of the conspirators.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It was given to us, actually, by some people who didn't want to hold it because it was too hot.
Yes.
And we said, we're crazy, we'll hold it. So we used it. But the point is, was Kennedy killed because he was John F. Kennedy? Or was President Kennedy killed because he was president?
That's the problem.
And that's right. And I lean to the second one.
Because he was the president.
That's right. He happened to have the misfortune of being the president at the time, which is the primary reason for it.
Right, and also the effect of television at that point was to make the president seem quite an important, charismatic character. And do you think the ruling forces were threatened by the image?
The project was, particularly after the agreements which were reached in London between Bertie Russell and Khrushchev's crowd in 1955, into the second and third Pugachev conferences of 1958. A deal was struck, which might be called New Yalta, might be called Trust 3.
Right.
And under this deal, it meant that world federalism, based on increasing work toward establishing global power sharing between Moscow and the Anglo-American liberals, was in the works. And it meant that the sovereign nation-state as an institution, and most emphatically the characteristics of the executive branch of the United States government, had to be eliminated. So that though John Kennedy's administration did a couple of good things, my direct knowledge is that John Kennedy's administration was no good and did some very nasty things. For example, John Kennedy's sponsoring of the space program was very good. The investment tax credit was very good, very useful, very important. I would fight for those things today.
Yes.
And I would have to, I'm obliged to credit the Kennedy administration with doing that. But from a standpoint of Western national security and from the standpoint of Kennedy's contributions to it, I think there's a large myth that Kennedy was, in a sense, a security risk.
But how was he a security risk?
Well, he was very soft on the Soviets.
Oh, I see.
Partly, I think, out of maybe personal cowardice. I don't know. Or maybe because he was a playboy and Avril Harriman and some other fellows were steering him. And McGeorge Bundy.
Yes.
Kennedy, Kissinger's sponsor of the period. I don't know why exactly, but I know he was a problem, and he was not a very serious president. He liked to chase girls more than he liked the presidency, but being president enabled him to chase more girls.
Right. So that he became president at the time when this movie, the Press 3, was beginning, and that's where he was unfortunate.
Yeah, it was reflected in the so-called Camp Spirit of Camp David under Eisenhower. The abortion of that in the U2 incident, in the Paris breakup, where Khrushchev blew up the negotiations with Eisenhower.
Now, that broke up the Trust III?
Well, no, it broke up the U.S. governmental motion in that direction. Then Kennedy came in. The Kennedy administration was actually a step toward. That is, the Cuba Missile, the Cuba Bay of Pigs, the Berlin crisis, the Cuba Missile crisis, were not really the Soviets, nasty old Soviets or somebody taking the U.S. by surprise. These were all a case of calculated weakness and free agreement within sections of U.S. establishment with Moscow. The myth of the Berlin crisis. Berlin crisis happened because the Kennedy administration had agreed to the partition of Berlin in that way.
Well, you know, this thinking that you're laying out here agrees a lot with Dr. Peter David Beter. Have you...
Oh, I know him.
You
I
met
know,
him.
I never met him, but Peter Beter? Yes, I know him.
Yeah, I know David Goldman was a friend of his.
Well, not sort of. Dave has met a lot of people. But, no, Peter Beter was... these often pick up things that are fairly important. But, no, I know that firsthand from the people on the scene.
Yeah, he says generally that was basically his scenario, is that there was a secret agreement between the Rockefellers and the Bolsheviks.
Well, that's true, but this was much more specific. This involved the George Mundy.
Yes.
It involved the Vienna meeting where Khrushchev personally physically terrorized John Kennedy in the other room. He threw him against the wall just to demonstrate, to play psychological games with Kennedy. And Kennedy capitulated. That as a result of that, the U.S. intelligence knew that Khrushchev was bluffing, that the East Germans did not do that on their own. They were ordered to by Khrushchev personally. They knew that Khrushchev was bluffing. They knew that if the United States called the bluff, Khrushchev would back down.
I see.
Kennedy personally, the White House, the Kennedy White House, ordered all information to that effect to be suppressed and not transmitted out of Germany. Adenauer, it is, refers to this. Then also, at the same time, it was known about the Khrushchev putting virtually two-thirds of the Soviet nuclear missile capacity at that time in Cuba. That was known.
Yeah, that's what Dr. Beter says, yes.
It was a treaty to that effect already signed. It was known at the time of the Berlin crisis. And it was because Kennedy signed on to allowing Gorbachev to pull off the bluff in Berlin that the deal...
Gorbachev? You mean Khrushchev?
Khrushchev, yeah. The same thing.
Yeah.
That the missile deployment occurred. I don't know why Kennedy decided to jot on the missile crisis the way he did, but I know that it was not Moscow that blinked. It was the United States that blinked in the Cuba Missile Crisis.
So there were people... forces. I mean, Kennedy even said there was a government behind his back. There was this group behind him that was orchestrating a lot of these crises.
It was essentially not unknown who they are.
Well, the Rockefellers, would they be part of them?
So I think the Rockefellers, that's where I would get off Beter a bit on, with my own view, is that I think that's exaggerated. Yes, the Rockefeller interest is very specific. I know the thing. I've done a lot in exposing it. And David Rockefeller is certainly no friend of mine.
Yes.
But I think that misses the point because it makes it too narrow and makes it too linear.
Right. In other words, it's the idea of the Fondi. It's a group of associates.
There's a social formation to the effect that no one individual or no one individual group determines the group. It's the inner within the group that determines what the group does.
Right, and that's why they can't put the finger on who killed Kennedy, those kind of things. They can't.
More than that, I think the problem is more than that. When you organize an assassination of that type for the President of the United States, a conspiracy which operated on the scale of which that thing operated. Remember, the killing of Kennedy enveloped and overlaid efforts to assassinate Charles de Gaulle.
Yes.
The same operation, in effect.
Yep.
So it's a vast conspiracy. Now, when you get a vast conspiracy What makes a conspiracy work is a lot of deception within the conspiracy and a lot of exploitation of the particular motivation of people who are drawn into playing particular roles. So that if you interrogate somebody and say, who pulled a trigger, and say, why was the President of the United States killed? Why'd you shoot him? This fellow might have a motive. He might simply say, because I was paid to do so.
Yes.
Or somebody else might explain a motive. That might have been the motive for their behavior or the induced motive. That doesn't mean that's why the thing happened. So that it comes to a question, the people who planned this, and this was, I don't think I should name it on the air.
Yes.
But the people who planned this were functioning at a very high level. So they knew what they were doing, unlike people on a lower level who may not have known fully what they were doing, apart from the killing. And even some didn't know they were involved in the killing.
Say that again?
They knew that they were destabilizing the institution of the presidency of the United States.
You just said those people on the lower levels didn't know what they were...
No, they didn't know the full implications of what
they were doing.
They knew what they were doing, but they didn't know what somebody else intended this to lead to.
Yes.
What they were doing was destabilizing, particularly with a cover-up, the Warren Commission cover-up. The combination of the assassination with the cover-up actually did destabilize the United States, destabilize the institutions of government of the United States, destroyed the presidency as an efficient instrument of government, as a constitutional instrument. And the fellows who organized this thing at that level knew they were doing this. So therefore, I say, if they weren't out to kill Kennedy, though somebody may have come up with motives for killing John F. Kennedy, they were out to kill President Kennedy because he was president.
The institution.
The institution.
Okay, you've made that clear. Now let's go to another charge. One thing. Why wouldn't you name the names? You are careful, even though you're in jail and people have been harassed.
Well, we're very careful because two reasons. First of all, it's a very sensitive issue.
Yeah.
It's not easily understood.
It's complex, yeah.
Right? And it would not be useful to name the names in a certain way because it would be misunderstood.
Right, okay. Now, as usual, through the last 15 years, you've been called anti-Semitic, your group. Now, I'd like to, and you even had the Israeli government protecting you, but here is a quote from a book, How to Defeat Liberalism and William F. Buckley, where you say, Nixon's 1960s practice is often misinterpreted as a trend toward deals with the Zionist lobby. Since such a description implies, however wrongly, a view of Jewish Americans generally, the term Zionist lobby is a dangerously misleading term unless emphatically qualified.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost like how you explained this thing about the Kennedy assassination. To continue. To equate Jewish Americans generally with a Zionist lobby is to degrade the ordinary citizen of Jewish religion or origins into a mere political commodity. To political chattels of the Rothschilds, Montefiores, Bronfmans, Max Jacobs, Max Fisher, and all. Since the Zionist lobby potencies are merely subordinates and political thugs for London and the Manhattan Episcopalian gang, Nixon's essential corruption was his selling out the existing mass base of the Republican Party in favor of corrupt deals with the Eastern liberal establishment. Then it just goes on. Now, the point is, to clarify how you... I've read other places where you say the right wing is mistaken in how they emphasize the Zionist lobby.
Yes, exactly, because it's a much more complicated phenomenon. What did you have? You have a bunch of people around saying, we are the Zionist lobby, or we're the Jewish lobby, and walking into various institutions and say, I speak in the name of the Jewish lobby. And I say, well, where's your patent of nobility here? Right? Who gave you this authority?
Yes.
You claim to represent something. What are you? So it's a bit of fakery. Now, there's some people who are ardent Zionists, but there are many kinds of Zionism. So which kind of a Zionist are you?
Yes.
You mean one kind of Zionist will kill another kind of Zionist. So don't tell me you represent both equally.
Yes, and that's the fractionalism in Israeli,
it's
Israeli
not
politics.
Israel, it's also throughout the world. You have a lot of people who are avid Zionists and will remain so as long as they're not compelled to live in Israel.
Mm-hmm. All right, so what would you like to say about the charge of your anti-Semitism?
It was just simply something cooked up. According to Canon West, of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, who told us about this before it happened. He said that we're going to tie them up in Jews. This is direct quote.
Who is he referring to?
He's referring to us.
That he's going to tie you up in Jews?
Yeah, well, the point is, remember, it's very credible. That is because we were having a fight with on financial issues.
Yes.
And with some of the Order of Malta. And he said, well, how are we going to deal with this by tying them up with Jews. He's a bit of an anti-Semite, among other things.
Yes.
He's a very powerful figure. But we knew how credible this was. Because the Anti-Defamation League, apart from being largely an offshoot of Meyer Lansky's mob, is through the Sterling National Bank, which is Meyer Lansky's bank.
Yes.
Was a creation of the Moore family at Chicago. It was created by the Moores, the family of Bishop Paul Moore, in Chicago. It was created as an anti-German propaganda organization of the Teddy Roosevelt anti-German variety before World War I.
Yes.
And then was moved later to New York, where it became part of Meyer Lansky's operation, and they attached to B'nai B'rith as a fifth wheel or something of that sort. And so, actually, we knew that the Moore and his interests did control the ADL. So, and this was started by the ADL in May of 1978, together with a operation by the Heritage Foundation and the Montpelerin Society, all starting the same operation at the same time, under the same sponsorship. So the anti-Semitic charge was the charge which was used by the ADL. Others used other charges.
But when you say they tied you up with Jews, you mean they wanted to associate you?
No, they wanted to get us into a brawl with the ADL.
Oh, that's what they mean.
The ADL at us in such a way as that we would, their fight with us would be covered by a distracting operation.
The anti-Semitic thing, I see.
That's right. It was to distract attention from the real issue. It's what Churchill called, the technique that Churchill called during World War II, the bodyguard of lies.
Yeah.
And the ADL, the Montpelerin Society, and the Heritage Foundation, all controlled by the same people, were used to constitute the bodyguard of lies.
All right. Now, which is a smokescreen.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, another major, the main thing used in the media is that many people think that you made the outrageous statement that the Queen pushes drugs.
Well,
now, I've read your literature, and I know it's more complicated than that. How would you explain that to my audience, what you mean?
Well, in 1982, a fellow who is a drug pusher, who was then employed by NBC TV News in its Chicago flagship station, did an interview with me, purportedly on the subject of the Dope Incorporated, a book.
Dope Incorporated, yes.
Now, he said, we refer in this book to the British role in drugs and said, are you calling the Queen a drug pusher? Which I said, well, in one part, I said, this is what's absurd. She doesn't sell nickel bags on the circle or some stupid thing like that.
Yeah.
But I said, she does have responsibility, referring to the book, in the sense, the moral responsibility, in the sense that she's the head of government of not only the United Kingdom, but of a number of Commonwealth countries. And referring again to what we discussed earlier in the interview, the money laundering problem through
yes.
offshore banks, that she knows this is going on and doesn't do much about it. And she doesn't do as much as her powers and influence would permit her to do. And in that sense, she's morally responsible. So for then NBC, then in 82, took that interview, a clip from that, as the basis for saying, he says the Queen of England pushes drugs. And then national NBC TV news in 1984 popularized by copying directly and adopting directly this Mark Niskanen thing from 1982. And that's how the thing was done. It just by complete repetition, constant
right.
repetition. I didn't happen to say that. By Henry Kissinger might be a different proposition.
Yes.
Because he'd do anything or anybody for money.
All right, well. Why do you think the Queen doesn't take responsibility for that situation?
It's a policy matter. It's an oligarchic matter.
This is where the funding comes in. She would be removed if she did.
Well, not only that, there's an effort to remove her now. There's some people who would like to have Prince Charles assume the throne and get her out quick, and she so far has been reluctant to go along with that arrangement.
Why do you think she is? Do you know?
I don't know. They're boosting Prince Charles. I know one good thing about Prince Charles. He's a cellist, an amateur cellist.
Yes.
He likes classical music from that standpoint. That's a good thing. So I always say, well, that's a good thing. I know a good thing about you, Prince Charles. let's be careful about this. Let's not go overboard. But he's being represented as being a wild Aquarian.
I see, yes.
And the apparent the parent motive, and of course his father, is associated with the World Wildlife Fund, which is a little more than Wile E. Aquarium. So that's being pushed. I don't know exactly what the internal politics of the royal family are.
All right. I think I understand. Let's move on. We're running out of time. Move on to the next topic. Why do you think the modern humanist should have a sense of classical tragedy?
Ah, that's history. Tragedy was invented as a way of teaching people the principles of history, essentially. That is, if we go back to, for example, Aeschylus. Or even if you look at the Homeric work, these are essentially tragedies in principle. But of course, Aeschylus introduces this great, masterful use of tragedy as a way of teaching history. Plato's dialogues are actually modeled on the tragedy. They are tragedies. The
yes.
Socratic method is the same method of tragic dialogue. Great drama, in turn, is based only on Aeschylus's tragedy, but it's based directly upon the Plato's Socratic dialogues.
Well, what is the tragedy?
Normally, mankind stumbles along in ordinary periods of survival, following certain lines of more or less traditional behavior or traditional development of behavior, and things go along fairly well. Then we come to a point at which everything begins to fall apart. And the reason things fall apart is not because of a particular problem, but because the prevailing set of beliefs is about the way policy is to be made prevents the society, or the leading institutions of the society, from choosing the kinds of alternate policies which would solve the problem. And therefore, crises arise not from the fact that problems arise, usually there are a few extraordinary exceptions, but in general, crises do not confront society because problems occur. Crises occur because every effort by society to solve the problem makes the problem worse, because society is incapable, apparently, of selecting anything but wrong solutions to this kind of problem.
I see.
And that is the definition of tragedy. A person gets in a situation, it's like the goldfish swimming, dumped out of a small bowl, dumped into a quite habitable and comfortable larger pond. And the goldfish for a while tends to swim in circles. So mankind, or the individual in history, the individual tragic figure in history, habituated to respond in a certain way, is dumped into a situation where a different kind of behavior is required, of which the individual is capable, potentially, but which the individual refuses to do.
All right, I understand that. Now, just to end off, do you like any part of jazz music, since you grew up in that period?
Oh, not particularly. I was always interested in it, up to a point, experimentally, as a way of sort of a random excursion to see, without liking it as music, what you could learn from it.
Yeah, you were interested in, you mean, what the experiments of jazz did, or you experimented?
The experimental aspect of it. It's like looking out of the corner of your eye. Huh? You always say, okay, now I know how to do certain things. I understand certain rules. I understand this field. Let me just go a little bit haywire here. Let's go out, look out this thing out of the corner of my eye. It's a little wild. And see if trying to reconcile what I know with something that's a little wild, if that broadens my conceptual overview of what I already know and jogs me to look for possibilities which I previously overlooked.
But in general, classical music is what you're really interested in.
The classical tradition even is always mine. It's the only musical tradition, actually, because it conforms to, of course, what I know to be aesthetical principles.
All right. Well, maybe in future interviews we can go into those. We have touched on those principles over the last four 1.5-hour interviews. Thank you very much, Mr. LaRouche, for taking the time to do this from your cell in you. I hope you are let out soon, that the movement, the international movement, grows to help you get out of the situation you're in. And I look forward to talking to you again.
Good to be with you.
Thank you, Mr. LaRouche. That's the International Connection for this week. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10 o'clock for more. I'm Bob Marshall for CKLN.